Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Parenthood Podcast. As a busy mother of two who is constantly trying to hold it together, dash to school just in time, just get the homework done, just catch the plane, when I inevitably drop everything, I occasionally feel let down by life. Why did that light have to turn red just before I crossed? Why was the tube delayed so I just missed pickup? Sometimes I find myself thinking, could anything else go wrong today? And then you read a story like Emma Campbell's, and you find yourself embarrassed by those thoughts, because what happened to Emma couldn't really have got any worse. It started with joy. After years of trying, she finally got pregnant, but ended up getting more than she bargained for, triplets. But within 6 months of her babies being born, she separated from their father and was diagnosed with breast cancer. Emma, thank you so much for joining me today. Having read your book, I'm sitting here in complete awe of you.
Thank you.
Forget blooming superwoman. I think you're one of the most inspirational women I've met.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank
it really
you.
Is an amazing, amazing book. But what really strikes me that it's not a book of woe, it's not a book of woe is me. It's an empowering, uplifting story of hope, resilience, friendship, generosity. And I think what struck me beyond the hardship that you endured, beyond the repeated chemo, beyond the breakdown of your relationship, the struggle of looking after not just one baby, but three, was it showed me how kind people are in life.
Incredibly so. I mean, I think that's what I wanted so much from writing this book was to... It was almost like a thank you to everybody that gathered around, held me emotionally throughout the most incredibly difficult time. And that continues now, really. I mean, I have attracted the most incredible good fortune in the darkest times. And I feel so, in a way, to sort of sound a bit corny and cliched, it was the lowest of times, but it was also, there were moments of magic throughout, from my cancer diagnosis onwards and the babies being born. And it continues, you know, I feel incredibly lucky in so many ways, despite the challenges that continue.
Well, Lena, you also realise that you're much stronger, I think, when the shit really hits the fan.
I think so. I mean, people sort of say that kind of, you're so strong, you're so brave. But I always say, I've had no choice, and you would be the same. If you know, you just have to deal with it. And I might look at another tragic story on the news, and you know, a parent who has lost a baby, and which you would know, and I would think, how are you breathing? How are you upright? How have you put one foot in front of the other? But you somehow have, and you found that strength. And I think in my situation, I just had no choice, and my motivation was so unwaveringly based on wanting to be there as their mum and stick around and get through and make up for the fact that the beginning of their life had been so unstable. And then not to mention, obviously, my eldest son, Jake, whose whole world imploded in a very short space of time.
But, I mean, triplets. I remember, you know, I see women the whole time struggling with one.
Yeah.
And then I remember when my second came along, you know, still... 17 months later, thinking, oh my God, I hardly have enough hands.
Yeah.
And then for you to give birth to triplets and then have to care for them on your own.
Yeah.
No.
It was completely bonkers and crazy.
Because we didn't even have three hands.
No.
So
no.
How does that work?
We were living in a top floor, lovely flat, but a top floor, small two bedroom flat. The baby, Jake, had one very small bedroom. The triplets were in three Moses baskets around the bed. The kitchen was two floors down. So I would sort of go upstairs at night with a tray with kind of 18, 21 bottles for all the night feeds. And it would take about 2.5 hours to do each feed. And they were being fed every 2 to 3 hours. So you kind of do the maths. It was just constant. The feeding just consumed every minute.
Because with twins,
day.
You can feed them together.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't breastfeeding. I expressed for several weeks. I wasn't able to breastfeed. And that's where obviously amazing friends, anyone who came to the flat knew that they would have to pick up a baby, and whether it was change a nappy or wind them or pick up a bottle, everybody stepped in. But there were obviously the majority of the time I was on my own, and I just somehow, it was a blur really. Those times were a blur.
One of the things we talked about recently actually on the podcast is guilt, and the sort of maternal guilt that seems to permeate every mother's life. You feel guilty about something, regardless, I think, of your circumstances. But then, you know, you obviously had the guilt in that you thought initially you were going to have one baby. Turned out that you were having two. You found that out at 12-week scan?
Found out it was IVF. Yeah. And I'd gone into the whole IVF process, obviously knowing how the statistics are not in our favour. And I thought, well, it'll be a miracle if we have one baby. The 6-7 week scan, they saw two heartbeats. Like, oh my goodness, okay, twins. Wow, okay, we can do this. Had regular scans up until 20 weeks. And at the 20-week scan, they found baby number 3, Theo, hiding away. And that just upped the ante unbelievably. And the guilt, I think, and then because of the chain of events, because separating from their dad, becoming ill, kind of life becoming so chaotic, I did feel, and I felt huge guilt over the years, because this kind of idyllic image I had of completing our family with one more child, Jake having this brother or sister, and it all being very neat and tidy.
And manageable.
Of course, and manageable. And of course that didn't happen. And the triplets are the best thing in the world. But it took things to a whole other level. And because of my fragile circumstances at that time, and with my health and with their dad, it just became a bit of a life was a nightmare, really. And very sadly, it's meant that there were very few happy memories of those early days, which really breaks my heart. I don't remember many moments of joy, because it really was just such heightened stress and exhaustion and trying to keep everything afloat, trying to be stable for Jake and keep life as normal as I could.
Do you have photo? I mean, did you have time to take photos?
Do you know what? I've only got about 2 photos of the pregnancy, which again makes me really sad, because now it's nearly 9 years ago. And if I think of what, you know, how much I'm on Instagram now and kind of constant snapping away and 7,000 pictures on my iPhone, I've got about 2 pictures of the pregnancy, which is such a shame. And then lots and lots of pictures of them as tiny babies. I don't know who's who. But yeah, lots of pictures. But just, I look at the photos of them, my beautiful babies, and I feel sad, because it was so hard.
And obviously that birth, I mean, a triplet pregnancy is high risk. It's really high risk.
Yeah.
You know, deal. And then presumably you, and doctors are very honest with you, aren't you, about...
Absolutely. And that's what... I never forget the day of the 20-week scan, and the room went very, very quiet, and the consultant was, well, was this IVF? Yeah, it was IVF. How many embryos? 2. Silence. And, you know, me and Jake and Jake's dad, we were looking at each other, going, what's going on? I think there's a third one in there. And it was just like the world sort of tilted on its axis. And I remember, but I just remember kind of Jake's euphoria. He was punching the air, kind of, yeah, mommy, wow, we're going to have 3 babies, whoop.
Buy 2, get 1
yeah,
free.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And his dad and I looking at each other kind of stunned, in shock. But the consultant just being so grave, that was the word. He just looked so grave and somber. And he said, as I was sort of wiping the jelly off and getting off the couch, he said, you know, if we'd known, this changes everything. It's very high risk. And if we'd known, we would have offered you a reduction.
As in taking
one
of them out.
Yeah, and I thinking, what do you mean? You know, what do you mean? Whatever this means for us now, never in a million, million, million years would that be an option, you know. So I remember sort of not being able to believe that he said that, but I guess he has to make that point.
Well, they have to make the emotionless decisions.
Of course. But I'd had, you know, I'd already had 3 miscarriages before being pregnant, you know, 4 years of secondary infertility. And I bled throughout the pregnancy, which was very, very frightening. So again, gosh, it sounds so gloomy. I didn't enjoy the pregnancy. There was no kind of rubbing my incredibly swollen belly and thinking of these, how our life was going to become so magical. It was very, very testing every single time. Anyone who's had any kind of baby loss, every time it went to the loo, you know, it was that kind of that terrible fear. I don't think I exhaled until they were out. And
even just, then, you know, it's not like then you sort of have them on your chest and you're wistfully bonding with them.
But I was very, very lucky because they all did incredibly well. There was no, you know, discrepancy in their weight. They were all about 4 pounds. They all came out, a little bit of help, you know, we were in hospital for another few weeks, but they did brilliantly. Very fit and strong, robust little creatures.
And one of the kind of feelings of guilt you talk about is for Jake, the fact that, you know, on the one hand, you were doing this for him because more than anything, you wanted to give him, the child you love most in the world, a sibling, not necessarily three. And one of the sentences that actually I really love in the book, you say that you feel that you robbed Jake of his childhood, you know, Jake who didn't ask for his cozy world of cuddles and kisses and safety and stability and routine to be turned on its head by a mum who got what she wanted and now couldn't cope.
Yeah, I think if I'm really, really honest, I told myself and everybody else that, you know, this obsession that consumed me for 4 years absolutely dominated every waking thought, to have another baby, have another baby. The story I told was, well, I'm doing this for Jake. He needs a sibling, you know. And that's true because, of course, most of us want our children to have a sibling. And my vision of a family, everyone has their vision of what their family is, whether that's one child or three or four or five. And I was one of two. My partner was one of two. We were like Jake and his brother or sister. But the level of obsession and the grip it had on me, it was my longing. And I say in the book, it was my womb bullying me. It's kind of how it felt. And I couldn't overcome it. It was so powerful. It was so all consuming. And of course, Jake's got riches in his life that he might not appreciate now, but he's got three siblings and that's wonderful. But he would have been okay. He would have been okay. And his life would have been calmer and more steady and stable. And I don't for a minute wish that is how it was. But I think I wasn't being entirely honest when I sort of said, oh, but I'm doing this for Jake. I was doing it for me and my longing and my dream that I couldn't let go of.
And do you think, I mean, interestingly, you know, we talked about this earlier, but after my son Willem died, I felt like I needed to have another child.
Yeah.
I needed to have this happy ending.
Yes. Yeah.
But for me, it was going to be very tricky because there was a high chance of another abruption happening, which is potentially fatal for me and for the baby. And I remember having a conversation with my mother and I said, you know, it's not that big a risk. It's quite big, but I think I should do it because I really feel I should have another child. Or maybe, you know, we discuss surrogacy and adoption. And my mother looked at me and she said, Marina, you have no idea how lucky you are. You have so much more than so many other people, and yet you're still wanting more, and you're wanting to risk all of this for what? For something that you already have two amazing children.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to tell a woman whose baby has died that she's being really quite selfish by wanting another. But I think I really respected my mother for having that conversation with me, and I valued that conversation because it was really the right decision for me, I feel now.
I feel like no one could have told me. I had many uncomfortable conversations where, you know, friends or family would say, come on, Emma, you know, you've got, you know, you're young, you're healthy, you've got a beautiful boy. Come on. You know, you're not enjoying Jake, you're not enjoying. But there were deaf words on deaf ears. They fell on deaf ears. And I think what happens as well, because, you know, with each miscarriage, and I know that other women would relate to this, the longing and the determination and the intensity, it fuels it even more. And then also I think because of what happened with Jake, very, very dramatic start to his life, I developed necrotizing fasciitis. So I had an emergency C-section, and within 48 hours I was sort of hovering between life and death, being gobbled up by this horrendous flesh-eating bug. So it's very dramatic. But because I felt I felt cheated of that experience of early motherhood, my beautiful baby, bonding. I was in intensive care for nearly 2 weeks I didn't see him. I couldn't breastfeed, that skin on skin wasn't there. So I feel that a lot of my sort of obsession was probably fueled by wanting to do it right, in inverted commas, to have the happy experience. And unfortunately, because of, I certainly would say if the triplet experience would have been a lot more positive if my personal life hadn't been so fragile at that point. You know, we would have, if we'd been a team, and that's, I'm not apportioning blame or anything, if we'd been more of a unit and things hadn't been as rocky, then I'm sure there would have been a lot. It was just very hard because I was so consumed by other things.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And the other kind of big guilt in your story is the guilt of them being a mum with cancer.
Yes.
And being consumed, not just physically, but, yeah, you know, mentally. I love the bit where you said, I was convinced I'd be the best kind of bustling, busy, bonny mum who loved to bake and read stories and draw pictures and play. Play? What's that? I never play. Yeah. I'm too busy, too tired, too irritated, too distracted, too scared of dying to play.
Yeah. And I think, again, I think I carry that feeling with me still. You know, my cancer, I had my first cancer diagnosis in 2010, had a recurrence 4 years ago. I'm currently doing well on lifelong treatment, but I am a cancer patient, and, you know, you only have to sit in the chemo ward at the Marsden to sort of know, we all know what cancer does and can do. And as a mum, I think, again, this guilt, you know, when you've wanted something so much, exactly what I said, I got what I wanted. I got these beautiful babies. And to feel that after pushing and pushing and doing everything I could to become a mum again, to then face the fact that I might not be here for them, that I might leave them behind, that I might abandon them, has been a horrendous thing for me to feel. But also I feel like my cancer experience has affected my parenting, because the fear at times has been so overwhelming of not being here, of dying prematurely, that I know that I think I've held back at times. I think because the pain of loving them, you know, when you love something so greatly, and the fear of the worst happening, I worry at times that it's affected the kind of mum that I have been, or I've become. I feel like I'm a different mum to the mum I was with Jake when life was simpler. And I, you know, in my early 30s, feeling invincible as we do. And second time around with Ella Louie and Theo, it's sadly been very, very fragile. But
have you ever talked to them about that?
They were tiny when I was diagnosed first time around, so obviously there was no need, and they wouldn't have understood. Second time around, I didn't lose my hair. I lost a lot of it, but I didn't lose all of my hair. So they were 4 or 5 years old. So they knew mummy was poorly, that mummy was going to hospital. But kids are incredible, as we know. Didn't really, you know, as long as life continued and dinner was on the table and TV was on and cuddles and kisses. With Jake, second time round, it was very, very different, because he was just started secondary school, you know, 11, 12 years old. And he knew, you know. I remember his face, kind of just the blood draining out of his face, and, "Mummy, are you going to be okay?" And I said, "Look, I'm going to be okay." I didn't know that, but I obviously that's what I said. So obviously he's had a very different experience as a brother who's 6.5 years older. It's been very different to him.
And did you pull back with him a bit too, or was it mostly?
No, I think, oh gosh, if Dave, my husband, was here, he would raise his eyebrows. I think I've been a different mum. I think with Jake, the feeling of not letting him down, but, you know, like I've said already, his life changed very dramatically from being in the home that we were in, mum and dad living there together, very safe and stable, to Papa no longer being around. three new siblings who distract, you know, who take were taking up all my time and energy. Mummy very ill, moving house, me at the hospital, you know, all it so, and also him seeing, witnessing quite a lot of relationship kind of, you know, not very nice scenes and things. I think I've overcompensated hugely with Jake because I felt so guilty that his life turned upside down. And I say at the end of the book, there's the most sort of, oh, incredibly healing moment one day a couple of years ago where one evening where I sort of ended up bursting into tears and saying, I'm sorry, Jake, I'm sorry, it's been so hard. And I'm sorry that, and he's like, Mum, it's fine, we're okay. You know, they're really annoying. They're annoying, Ella, Louis and Theo, but they're great. I love them. And I'd hate to be an only child. And he just sort of healed me. It was like, okay, so you're okay with this. You're okay with the mess it's all been. You know, I just feel like, to put it in a nutshell, on my dark days, I can feel like my longing kind of created a bit of a mess. And I don't mean that my children are the mess. Ella, Louis and Theo are not the mess. They're the gift. But it wasn't their fault either. You know, and it wasn't my fault. I know that. And it wasn't their dad's fault. But it was just an extraordinary set of circumstances in a very condensed time that made life as we knew it kind of implode. And so it really has been a case of building a new life as a single parent, as a recovering cancer patient who's then living with a permanent fear of coming back, which it did, and managing, you know, I'm not the mum I thought I would be because I...
But are any of us?
No, but I'm not that bustling Bonnie Enid Blyton mum because I
thought... No one is.
I know.
Not even Enid Blyton was. Wasn't she like the meanest person?
No, that's true. That's very true. But I remember thinking in the years of secondary infertility, I want the chaos. I want the noise. I want the mess. And actually, I struggle with that. I struggle with the drawing on the wall and the constant... I struggle with it. And so... And then I feel like I have no right to... Anyway, I could beat myself up all day. I'm trying to beat myself up less.
But I think what people love about the book and what I loved about it is that I didn't have triplets. I didn't have cancer. And yet I recognise so many of the struggles that you describe so beautifully. And I think that one in particular, you know, we all had ideas of what we were going to be like as parents and we weren't those people. Mm. And I think every mother feels guilt that she snapped or that she wasn't as cool and fun. And God, the fights I've had last week with Iona because she doesn't want to wear what I want her to wear because she wants to wear shorts and a t-shirt, not a dress.
Yeah,
and I'm looking at myself going, Marina, you're not this person who cares that she should wear a pretty dress. Why are you even having this horrible, destructive argument? And yet I can't help myself.
I know.
But I think that is symptomatic of all parents.
Yeah.
You know, and you all feel guilty. You know, if you had had just one baby and if you hadn't had cancer and if your marriage hadn't imploded, you'd have still felt guilty. And I almost think you'd have still felt the same levels of guilt.
I think so. I mean, there was the most heartbreaking a couple of weeks ago. Louis came downstairs and it hadn't been an awful, I hadn't been shouting and screaming and kind of anything. But I think bedtime's always pretty, you know, challenging as any mum knows.
Because we're at the end of our tether.
Yeah, and I is at my low point. Beyond 7 o'clock, I'm kind of hanging on by a thread. But he came down and I thought, and his lips were wobbling, his eyes filled up with tears. I was like, darling, what is it? Mummy, I just feel so sorry for you because you didn't know you were going to have three babies. And I was like, darling, you know, and I obviously gave him the biggest hug and I said, I love, you know, you're the best thing ever. But it's that kind of contradiction of they are the best thing ever. I am the luckiest mother alive is how I feel. But it's really bloody hard. And I think that's the constant kind of conflict. If I'm so lucky, but it's hard. I could be dead now. I'm well. I'm doing okay. But it's hard, you know, letting myself... saying to myself, it's okay that it's hard, but...
I don't know. Obviously, you know no different, you know.
Yeah.
You don't know what it's like just to have... the 2.4 children that you kind of wanted, and yet so much of what you talk about I recognize and you know, I think we beat ourselves up too much personally. I think we all do that and we're all constantly pinching ourselves at how lucky we are
and having
dichotomy of feelings.
I know. Exactly. And I've just got to trust that this is their life experience, this is the childhood that they are experiencing, and I've just got to hope and trust that they feel my love and they... It's chaotic and it's crazy and there's a lot of shouting and there's tears and... But I hope they feel the love because...
Well, you know what? Children are honest. They're not polite. They're certainly not polite to their parents. Mm. So the fact that Jake said, you know...
I know, he wouldn't have it any other way, actually.
He wouldn't have it any other way. He wasn't saying that just to get brownie points to make you like him. Like, he knows you love him unconditionally. Mm. So I think if you they're all right.
Yes, they're okay.
I think you're doing, you've done like a triple A star parenting.
Oh my goodness.
In terms of sort of looking forward with your cancer, this is ongoing treatment.
Yeah, so the recurrence, so having nearly hit the 5-year point, feeling on top of the world, I was, having my green smoothies every day, I was exercising, I was just started after 5-6 years of single life, I was tentatively doing a little bit of dating. I felt brilliant. I felt like I'd done it. And, I was blindsided when I found out my cancer had returned. And me being me, I was so scared and fearful that I didn't ask many questions. I never do. But as a result, I didn't realise straight away. It was a localised recurrence, but it was as though the world had ended. But it was localised. So they get me back on chemo and lots of hormone treatment. And that treatment is continuing. But I've done really, really well. I'm in remission. I've been in remission for 4 years. I have 3-weekly treatment. And I've just got to hope that it remains contained. It's a funny situation to be in because people sort of say, you've got cancer. And it's like, well, have I got cancer? Because I'm doing really well. Is it there? Is it lurking? Is it gone forever? And I think with patients like me, that's the slightly tricky one now. With the drugs are so incredible, so effective, so powerful, but the oncology team, because you could say, well, why are you still on it? You're doing okay. You've been clear for 4 years. They don't know if it's being suppressed or whether it's gone for good, and they're not going to take that chance. If I'm lucky enough to remain well and cancer with no signs of active disease for several more years, then maybe that conversation will happen. But right now, as far as I know, my treatment is lifelong, and but it's I guess life is it, and it's been a phrase that's been used a lot, but it's my normal. That is my normal. I am a cancer patient. I'm doing really well. It's in my life. It's lurking, but.
Well, also, you pinch yourself that you're lucky to be in London with the Marsden.
Absolutely. I've got incredible care. I've responded my body. I have to love my body. My body has responded amazingly to the drugs. It's my mind. My mind is the struggle, really, I think.
Which is the same for all of us.
Yeah.
I loved the sort of narrative around friendship in the book. Mm. The fact that you found yourself a single mum of four with breast cancer. And, not just mild. This was quite severe.
Yeah.
And the stories of support and generosity and friendship from those you knew, but also those you didn't
know. I know, far and wide. I mean, there was the, my inner circle, the school mum friends, the lifelong friends who I talk about, the rota that was drawn up, without me knowing, coffee shops kind of, right, okay, so. And they learned very quickly on, and I think any cancer patient or person who's dealing with health struggles, you haven't got the energy to tell people what you want. So the magic is when friends, family, loved ones, distant strangers just take action anyway. That's the gift. Turning up and with the lovely frozen meals or the bolognese or whatever it is, or treats for the kids, or turning up and just emptying the dishwasher. So rather than because it's so exhausting, and it's exhausting telling people what you need and trying to think of what you need. So you're not going to say to your friend, would you mind emptying the dishwasher or hanging up the washing? But when they just do it, it's the most wonderful gift. And I had incredible, I'm beyond fortunate with the love and the care and the kindness and the spontaneous acts of kindness that were shown to me. I could have written 3 books listing all of the acts of kindness.
And even just, the fact that word got around your community, and you said sort of a friend of a friend had a maternity nurse, and they were discussing,
gosh,
and
I
the
know,
maternity
I
nurse
know.
Said, well, I'm free next week, I'll go.
I'm going to donate. She don't, we all know maternity nurses are quite, it's quite a pricey option to take. And she said, donated a week of her time. Which we saved it. It all happened quite early on, and we saved it for when the mastectomy happened, because I knew that was going to be the lowest point in terms of my physical strength. The little old lady in Marks and Spencer's who came up to me and put £5 in my hand, and oh gosh, I could go on and on. Lovely Natasha Kaplinsky, who I met through a friend, who turned up at my kitchen, took all my washing away, made loads of bolognese, and her husband came around the next morning and changed the light bulbs. You know, mad, kind of comical, funny, wonderful, touching. And actually, I got really good at just saying, okay. You know, I stopped saying, no, you can't. Like, okay, thank you, you know. Yeah. When you're at that point, you just, I had no choice but to let it in. And, you know, having to believe that I would do the same if it was someone else.
And that, you know what, I think it's a privilege to be able to help someone. Yeah. It feels like...
people want to. It's so funny that you said, neighbours of mine, some of my lovely neighbours that I mentioned in the book, and Peter, my neighbour... I remember I think it was a couple of summers ago before Dave moved in, and he said, he knocked on my door one Sunday morning and he said, Emma, I thought I'd mow your lawn this morning. Oh, no, Peter, you can't, it's fine. Garden's a wreck. He went, Emma, just receive. And it was just let it in.
It's not an option. It's just, not would you like
just
me.
Just let it in, it's okay. And in a way, I try and view life like that, you know, just sort of open my arms up and... okay, the tough stuff comes in, but also the good, you know. There's so much good. And in the darkest times, and I think, going off on a tangent now, but I think if it's taught me anything, without, again, I don't want to be corny or Clinton's card-esque, but I just try and appreciate the good, because there's so much magic around in amongst all the tough stuff. There really is. And I don't know, you know, I obviously would like to have had a life without cancer. But the riches that have come my way, the emotional riches, the deep friendships, the love, it's just been incredible. That's changed me, I think.
And
I
the
think
love, yeah. As in the actual love.
Yes, so, Mr. Dave the Carpet. I know, in the magical way that happened. I mean, that's a story.
It's a story. I'll leave the story for the book, but it is. It's almost like a fairy tale.
It is a bit
it's
of a fairy tale.
Sort of modern day fairy tale. Yeah. It's way better than Snow White.
Yes.
Better.
It really is. It's a story.
So practical things, only because people do listen to this podcast, I know. And I think, you know, what I take from our conversation is, you know, what you can do for people for whom, you know, it is pretty terrible, and sort of not asking is obviously one, and thinking practically, what do you not have the energy to do? Like the light bulbs, it's something I can't stand doing.
Yeah.
And I never have the right light bulbs anyway. So God, if someone came in and just changed the light, that would be one of those things that I'd be sort of so immeasurably grateful for.
Yeah.
What did you, was there anything that you wish you'd known when you were diagnosed? Because obviously that shock, you probably can't remember that
much. I wish
much
I'd known.
It.
I mean, I think, you know, because I wasn't just dealing with cancer, you know, life was already kind of fairly rock bottom, you know, splitting up with their dad, living in a totally inappropriate flat, up a million stairs. I was kind of, cancer was just one other thing that was going on. And in a way, if I'm honest, what's interesting is that you have the horrendous shock of the diagnosis, but then you step onto that conveyor belt of treatment, and your diary's full with appointments, with treatment, with recovery. You know, you get to know the routine, and actually, it sort of slotted into my life. But I wish I'd known. I didn't have the time to connect with other women, whereas now there are amazing women in my life who are living with cancer, and through social media, through. Other things, those women are a huge comfort to me, seeing how they go about their daily lives and the courage that they show. But 8-9 years ago, even if Instagram had been around, I don't know if I would have had the time to sort of focus on it. But it's been a huge comfort. I did feel very isolated, because I didn't want to sit in a support group in a dusty church hall, and I was too scared to kind of hear other women's stories, because I didn't want to hear the gloomy ones. And I wish I'd known that there are so many of us, so many men, women living with cancer, facing it, coming through, or living with ongoing treatment, but finding a way to still find joy and to still be mum, to still, it's not the end. It's not necessarily the end, you know. I wish I hadn't been so crippled with fear, but then that's me, you know, I don't know.
Do you think if you'd, I mean, that... I see now on social media, there are so many amazing blogs and Instagram accounts of women like you who... Yeah. You know, and I've interviewed a few of them on this podcast who just see the light and say, actually, it was awful, but I've grown as a person and I feel that I'm kinder and wiser and my life's been richer as a result.
I know my life is so much bigger today than it was 10, 15 years ago, without a doubt. I know that I've had experiences, I've got deep connections with people that weren't there. I know myself, I'm more confident in myself now at the age I am than I ever was in my 20s or early 30s. It shaped me, it's molded me, it's stripped me back. You know, you are raw and you are vulnerable and you're stripped back. That's how you're exposed, you're all of those vulnerable things, but I've realised how wonderful vulnerability is. Vulnerability is, such beauty can come from that. Mm. And I just feel so strongly about speaking my truth, about living my, finding the joy. You know, I need to, you know, I struggle on a daily basis with feeling fearful and anxious, and I've only got to have a sore throat and I can go to a very dark place. But I'm trying so hard each day to minimise those thoughts and to expand on the other ones, because otherwise it's a tragic, tragic waste. And I've got this chance now. I am, this minute right now, I'm okay. We don't know about anything else, but right now I'm okay. And if I don't find the joy in today, then it really is a bit of a tragedy, isn't it?
But you that's know. The circle, isn't it? You talked about the guilt you felt that cancer robbed you of being a mother, but you know, yes, it may have taken you away for a bit, but it's returned you a stronger, more resilient, better
I hope so.
Figure.
I mean, when I'm feeling good and when I'm feeling well and when I'm feeling like cancer is quite minimized, then I feel that that's all true. The tricky points and where I let myself down as a mum is if there are hospital appointments looming, if I'm waiting for results, if I'm feeling run down, and if I'm worrying about something physically, feeling a lump or a bump, I feel so crippled with the fear that I then withdraw from the kids. Like I probably said this already. And I am so distracted and so in my own head that they are an intrusion. And I feel that's when the irritability and the kind of lack of tolerance and not being present, I'm not present. And that's something that's an ongoing thing for me. Trying to be present with them despite the chatter in my head of what if, you know.
But you've recognised that.
Yeah.
And that's the first step.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of cancer, what message do we need to send out? I mean, obviously, women in their 40s, 50s are at biggest risk of cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, we all know we need to check our breasts, but what do we need to be doing?
I mean, I think what shocks me still every, you know, when I'm at the hospital every few weeks is how many young women, if we're talking about breast, obviously men, women, we're talking about breast cancer in particular, how many young women I see. And we know that diagnosis is happening earlier and earlier.
Which is a good thing.
Which is, yeah, but as in...
Oh, earlier.
There is, yeah,
yes.
As in there are more... They just
younger.
See, yeah, younger. I think, again, I'm not a great example of someone who has acted on concerns. I've buried my head in the sand. You know, I felt physical changes in my breast after the triplets were born, after expressing, after the IVF, and I kept brushing them aside. And I did that again the second time around when a rash appeared on my chest. I was so scared of being told bad news that I just... So I am not a good example of someone who rings up the doctor at the first sign of anything, but that's obviously what needs to happen. And I know it now, but I still struggle with that because the fear can feel so great. So someone might say, oh, but you're worried about that. You know, I've had a few headaches recently, which now thankfully have stopped. But there was a point a couple of weeks ago where, oh God, I don't get, why am I having all these headaches? And, you know, friends would say, oh, just pop along to the hospital. And I'd want to scream, don't you know how frightening that is? Just popping along to the hospital when you're living with cancer is so terrifying because you know that, you know what could happen. But obviously we need to be vigilant. We need to know what's right for our bodies, what for our breasts. We need to act, we need to feel the fear and do it anyway. And make that call and get checked out.
And you don't want to be hyper worried about
every
single headache.
No, that's the thing as well.
Exactly.
It's like, it's that hyper vigilance that inevitably happens when you've faced death on several occasions. And it's balancing it all, isn't it? It's keeping some perspective. And as my GP said to me a couple of weeks ago, you know, what did she say? Something like, common things are common, but like most headaches aren't a brain tumor, you know. But in my world, in anyone who has faced cancer and that has heard the worst, you do tend to think like that, you know.
So just being aware and
being
checking
aware
our breasts.
And being and checking our breasts and being brave. And
because our breasts change and we have babies anyway.
Absolutely,
and when we're
absolutely.
Expressing
yeah.
and feeding and all
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, no, these are definitely sort of milk lumps.
Yeah.
And they were, luckily.
Yeah.
But I kind of think you either at home and you're worrying and you're not relaxed.
Exactly.
So you might, if that's happening, you need to just go and get checked out.
I know. And that's something, it's a work in progress for me. But absolutely, I would say to you, to anyone else, what are you doing? You know, it's just practicing what we preach, isn't it?
I'm being aware. Emma, thank you so much for joining me today. Emma's book is amazing. It's called All That Followed, A Story of Cancer, Kids and the Fear of Leaving Too Soon. It's available on Amazon and from all good bookshops. It is a brilliant read.
Thank you. It's uplifting
and funny and honest. And I think regardless of whether or not you have cancer or triplets or a single mum, you will find so much that sort of resonates. So I'd highly recommend it.
Thank you.
You can also follow Emma on Instagram. She's at M+4, as in the digit 4. And you can read her blog at meandmy4.com. Thanks so much for coming
along today. Thank you for having me.
So great to chat to you. Thanks for downloading another episode of The Parenthood. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate and review us. It makes it easier for people to find us. And if you've enjoyed this, please do spread the word. But in the meantime, from Emma and me, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.